This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Tonight, we'll talk about concentration. What do you guys think when you hear that word? That's the topic, homework? Yeah? Concentration?
Lack of.
Lack of, yeah. So, this is a very key subject in the path, I would say. It gets defined in different ways. But one definition, the definition offered by my teacher, is that it is the ability to attend to what is deemed relevant. The ability to attend to what is deemed relevant.
Shinzen?
That's Shinzen, yeah. And so the traditional word and definition comes out of a kind of the unification of mind, the gathering together of the mind. That the lack of concentration feels like the mind is kind of fragmented, right? And concentration feels like a gathering together. The full energy of the mind being directed towards one thing rather than directed in a million different ways. Because we all know the experience of the unconcentrated mind, right? I mean, this is the first lesson of meditation practice, right? And so one, I think it's from the Tibetan tradition, one metaphor for this is that we're like a monkey in a room with six windows for the five senses and thought. And the monkey is just in the room running from window to window. And it's like, looks out and it's like, oh, this is the sight window. Oh. And it's like, bored. Sound, let's go for sound. No thinking, no feeling, you know, right? And it's just, and this is, it's like ping pong, right? Again, this is my teacher who said, simply stated, concentration power is the single most universally applicable and most deeply empowering skill that a human being can cultivate. That's a pretty radical statement. Concentration power is the single most universally applicable and most deeply empowering skill that a human can cultivate. And the reason that he says this is that concentration makes everything better. It makes pleasure more enriching and fulfilling. It makes pain less distressing often. It makes our any activity, we're actually more successful when the mind is gathered together. And for me, the suffering, to some extent, is synonymous with the very scattered mind. Like if you think back to times when you've suffered the most, the mind is out of control, right? And so there's that sense of that kind of ping-ponging effect, you know, like the monkey in the room. And so I move from physical discomfort to emotional discomfort to thinking and worrying about the future to regretting the past. And it's like the attention is like in one of the pinball machines, you know, and it's just all over. And that really is suffering for me. And so there's something to this gathering, this ability to bring the mind into oneness and to begin to allow all of the arisings, because there's always something else arising other than what we're attending to, for those arisings to become less sticky and pull us in less. There's a classic distinction between mindfulness and concentration. But in my experience and from my experience with a couple different teachers, the distinction is a little artificial. That they're meant to come together. And in fact, mindfulness, to be mindful, say we're attending in a very open way to the body as we did today. Actually, to sustain the awareness of the body, to keep the attention in the body, even if we're moving from place to place in the body, to sustain the attention and not be dragged under the stream of discursive thought takes a lot of concentration. So sometimes the distinction is made that mindfulness is broad and concentration is narrow. But mindfulness that is broad is really requires a great deal of concentration. And so the way that it's been depicted again by my teacher is that concentration can come in narrow or expansive flavors. It can come in the form of attending to this area right here with the breath and to the exclusion of everything else, the entire world disappearing, and there's just this. Or it can be the concentration that is aware of body, mind, sight, and sound. And the training in concentration, samadhi, figures into the Buddhist teachings in a prominent way. It sort of described sometimes as three trainings: conduct, wisdom, and concentration, or mind training. And as we'll see, as I'll talk about, these factors influence one another. That all the Buddha's lists start with these neat categories, but then you get into them and you see how they lean on each other. They have effects that go both ways. Our conduct affects our concentration. concentration affects our conduct. And I would say that a lot of the Dharma, a lot of these teachings of the Buddha can't be understood without some level of concentration. They're just words. And this is tricky for somebody like me who's talking about the practice. Because we can get some taste of what the Buddha is suggesting. But to really verify that this isn't just a bunch of New Age BS, we have to deepen this unification of mind to really see for ourselves, as the Buddha said. See for yourself. And that takes a kind of steadiness of vision. So Gil Fronsdale said, gave the metaphor that if you were looking into a telescope, into the distance, or into a microscope to examine our life real close, if the telescope or microscope was shaking, you can't see what you're looking at, right? And concentration is the stabilization of the attention. It's the telescope becoming still. And then all of a sudden, what might have looked like this blurry white and darkness becomes the moon with features that we can see. And it's darker here, and there's a crater there. Yeah, Miles?
I'm curious how you would distinguish this. Because my experience, dukkha, feels a lot like concentration. Feels like fixation. It feels like single-minded, pointed, I cannot get off of this one particular thought, feeling. I can't, that I'm totally concentrated on this one thing. It's not a matter of my mind bouncing around. It's my mind choosing an object and clinging, grasping to something negative and not, and it sort of, I almost need to be knocked at the head to stop my concentration.
Yeah. It's an important distinction because you are right that a lot of pain revolves around a kind of fixation or gripping power of certain thoughts or feelings. And this is actually not concentration, but something more like rumination. And concentration would actually be the power to move the attention out of that loop. And as we develop more and more concentration, we feel less and less compulsive in closing the loop of our thought. And so you may notice this in meditation, that it's like there's a loop, it's going, right? It's like almost through. You notice, you wake up, oh, I'm thinking. And then it's like, okay, Matthew's talking about the breath or some nonsense, but I want to finish this thought. And it's like, are we going to let go or close that? and the ability to let go here instead of again and again the loop, the loop, the loop. It comes with some ability to redirect the attention. That is concentration power. That is concentration power. So the prescription for rumination and obsessional thinking is actually this kind of practice. And that's even, there's even some research data around, like, why does mindfulness help around anxiety and depression? Is that it actually seems to work against exactly what you're describing. So it's humbling to meditate, right? Is it not humbling? No? Well, let me explain why I say that. It's humbling insofar as the first time I meditated and I had the experience of the monkey running to all the six windows, I was kind of shocked. Because I had thought that I was more or less in control of my mind. And then, oh, you want me to pay attention to my breath? No problem. How long? An hour, 2 hours? You just tell me. And then I close my eyes for 2 minutes. This was the length of my meditation period when I started practice. 2 minutes. I would set my watch. And it's like a circus in there, you know? And like, this is a little hard to take on board, you know? Not take this so personally, like, oh, I'm a bad person, I'm a bad meditator, I'm bad this or that. And even still, after thousands of hours of meditation practice, and there's a period where the mind is really relentless, and I'm like, have I meditated before, ever? Hmm? Some humility.
That's funny.
It's funny.
I laugh at it.
I do too. The only reason I'm still practicing is because that didn't hurt. Because if that... It is. If it hurts, we're not going to make it. If we can actually be playful with it. It's not just me, it's 6.5 billion people walking around like this. Right?
I was thinking, what was the difference between shame, you know, something being a shameful experience and being a humbling experience?
Yeah, yeah. I would say that the humbling experience is not taken as condemnation of who we are at the deepest level. So the motivation to practice can come out of this seeing. Some people see this, the frantic mind, and they just hightail it the other way. Like, I'll let somebody else deal with that. Of course, this mind is not something we can actually hightail away from. But sometimes, and I understand, that's the reaction. And some people, and certainly some of you, see this and the urgency of practice, of mind training, becomes important. And so when I started practice, I wasn't getting any peace. I wasn't having the experience that you described of containment. I wasn't having any insight into the nature of the self. Like, I was totally scattered. But I would get up and say, something needs to be done here. And so we can allow this insight actually to deepen our intention to practice. Now, this capacity to stay steady and focused in our attention is important because when we get totally lost in our thoughts, when we don't know thinking as thinking, we live in whatever world is formed by those thoughts. So have you noticed that when you wake up from a daydream during meditation, you didn't know where you were, that you were meditating. You took on the characteristics of whatever was arising in those thoughts. We live in that realm. And the mind will just take us where the habits take us. The mind is, our habits are driving that taxi, and it's going wherever our habits take us. And the awareness is required to begin to break out of that insulated story, which is not true. It's not true. It's never all true. So I want to talk about some things that support concentration. And concentration, like everything, arises out of causes and conditions. It doesn't arise out of thin air. It arises in relationship. It is born of other things. And so I want to talk of some of the things that it's born of. Things that support the deepening of concentration. Joseph Goldstein says that the first thing, which is not what you want to hear. This is the kind of, I guess I knew that. But he said that the main training is one in patience and perseverance. That the mind changes gradually, it becomes unified gradually, and that there aren't real shortcuts. You know, that it's a training in the same way that we would train to run a marathon. And each time we return the attention to the breath or to our object of focus, this is, as my teacher says, one rep. We're doing one rep. So some of this just evolves over time with practice. But that answer, I know, is not satisfying, so let me say some more. It's said that in the one of the Buddha's depictions of how freedom comes to be, and that it's a series of causes and conditions, and one thing leads to another and leads to another, and we get more and more free. It's said that happiness, well-being, precedes concentration. That it's actually out of the gladness of the mind that we can begin to focus in a more unified way. And that to get concentrated when we're really unhappy is hard. It's hard. And in a lot of psychological distress, the disruptions of attention is a hallmark. And we want to work in ways to... This path is working on us in a lot of different ways to become happier. And it's worth engaging in whatever other work is to be done in psychotherapy or 12-step or support of one kind or another. And that from some of this adjustment and a more sense of gladness, the mind can gather. Conduct, our good conduct, maybe we don't see its relation immediately to the mind, but when we're doing harm, we're working strongly against the concentration of mind. That when we do things that are unskillful, that harm ourselves or others, there's a part of the mind that's just disavowing it and denying that this is even happening, that there's harm happening. We rationalize it, we say this or that to ourselves. We basically won't allow ourselves to look at how we have to close our heart to do harm. And so we try to wall it off and continue to engage in unskillful, harmful behavior. But it can't work. Because meditation, when we actually get relaxed enough, that stuff needs to be digested. It wants to be digested. And so it intrudes into awareness. It comes in like a kind of ghost haunting the mind. And part of developing concentration is beginning to lead a life that feels non-harming, that feels like it has a lot of integrity. And as I mentioned recently, it's like Mark Twain said, if you're honest, you don't have to remember anything. Right? And if you're not harming, you don't really have to think about anything.
This is one of the few, very, very few ongoing challenges I have with Buddhist teaching. A police officer sees someone committing a crime and has to harm that person to stop them. He's doing harm. A soldier is doing his job, preventing some evil. He's doing harm. You can play semantic terms and say, well, ultimately stopping the evildoer is not harming them. You're helping them to face the consequences. Nonetheless, you're using violence to stop something. So, my question is, I know I'm referring to Buddhist doctrine, so that it's some monolithic, complete, in agreement thing. But can you take violent action and still be following Buddhist teaching?
There is no way I'm going to answer that question. It's a good one. It's a really good one. And total,
what was God doing before he created the universe?
Totally legitimate.
Making out for people ask questions like that.
Totally legitimate, and I don't mean to be shaming at all, but it is. Okay. We have 10 minutes, and that is 2 to 3 hours, and okay. It'll be. So let me.
You're saying there's an answer to that?
There's a Buddhist answer. I don't. Okay. As if that legitimate question was not asked. Let me say a few more things. We're going to run out of time. And I'm not even going to talk about rapture. I'm always talking about pain. Okay.
We'll get to rapture next time?
Well, no, I'm gonna squeeze it in. Rapture for the homework. So a few more things. So our conduct is key. We need to develop some, it's like disenchantment or fatigue with the promises the mind always holds out. That when we get hooked in meditation, we are usually following some storyline that is supposed to lead us to pleasure and safety and away from danger. And we begin to just get, we lose hope that we can find our happiness within the realm of thought. And so, more and more, it's like the thoughts become less compelling, less sticky. And so the thought of some pleasure arises, or the thought of avoiding some pain arises, and we know that it's a kind of a dead end, and we can just let go. Sometimes aversive feeling in the body drives discursive thought in the mind, and it's an unwillingness to be present with the intensity of the emotional sensation in the body. And so we think and think and think, and it's a little bit like redirecting our attention from something that's too painful for us to handle. We imagine it's too painful, but we can tune in to the discomfort in the body, stay with that, and this can help stabilize the mind. We're also working to blanket our day with more mindfulness, because what we don't attend to remains undigested. It remains undigested, and it naturally is going to arise when we sit down. So as we learn to pay more and more attention, we kind of digest the excitement of our lives, digest the activity of our lives as the day goes. And so when we sit, there's less to digest. Now, during meditation, we can use labels, and some teachers really insist upon this, that if we're doing the breath, we would label in and out, or with the breath, we would say the word gently, calm as we breathe in, and peace as we breathe out, something like this. Shinzen recommends sometimes using spoken labels. So if we come to him on retreat and say, I can't concentrate, he says, oh, the first question is, have you used spoken labels? Which would mean going to your room and actually speaking the labels out loud. So again, if it was the breath of in and out, I could say that out loud. And it does create a kind of feedback loop, and it seems to dampen the thinking circuits in a strong way. We are also learning to release the need to understand everything at all times. The mind is so uncomfortable not knowing, not understanding what's happening. And so we pay attention to objects of meditation, but we're constantly picking them up and trying to hold on and understand them and squeeze some insight from them. my mind is like this. It wants to be having insight from the first bell to the last bell. And so I pay attention to my breath, and then I'm thinking like, what did I just learn? Am I happier? What did I get? Right? And so we have to let go of that need. Let go of that need to always understand. And just to rest in the wordless awareness. And the last thing I'll say is that the way the Buddha defines concentration actually is the attainment of the jhanas, which are the meditative absorptions. And the jhanas are arranged in different ways, but often eight jhanas, and these are distinct states where the focus has stabilized so deeply that there is nothing but this different experiences that are said to be a beginning to approach the unconditioned, as close as we get to the experience of absolute freedom that is not yet absolute freedom. And so this is the Buddha's description. Just as a lake with spring water welling up from within, having no inflow from east, west, north, or south, so cool that the fountain of water welling up from within the lake would permeate and suffuse and fill it with cool waters, there being no part of the lake unpervaded by the cool waters. Even so, the monk permeates this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. There is nothing of his or her entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of concentration. And these states are attainable. I don't use that language often of this is attainable, we need to go get it. And so be careful how the mind picks that up. But it's said that dwelling in jhana begins to transform the mind and heart in a deep way. That it can't do everything and wisdom is needed. But that this deep gathering of the mind and this availability of a refuge of rapture leads us onwards towards more and more freedom, towards a life that is more and more fulfilling, less and less harming. So the encouragement is pick up these teachings, what's been said, and see what's of value for you. See what's of value. We're all doing this work, and doing things like this, we are doing this work, gathering the mind, even though it feels frustrating and trying at times.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.